Where have all the men gone? That sounds a bit odd when I ask that. Where has manhood gone? Well, let's ask Betsy Hart, who is a writer and a broadcaster, a frequent guest on CNN and Fox News. She's in Chicago, a great city now. Welcome to you. Merry Christmas.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. Merry Christmas to you, too. I'm delighted we can actually say Merry Christmas instead of Happy Holidays or some other euphemism. So,
it's compulsory here. We've got a place outside where we shoot people who don't say it. Now, is this true? Has there been an emasculation of greater society? Is manhood under threat?
I think it is under threat, Michael, and there's a couple of big hints to that. Not least of all, it's something a lot of people, at least here in the States, are talking about. But you can get some strong hints of it just by watching television. If you look at not only commercials, but sitcoms, dramas, husbands and fathers are always complete idiots who have to be saved from the day by their ever more intelligent and competent wives and children. And that's just one example of sort of the dumbing down of manhood we have, where it's sort of this, what I've come to call the man bad, woman good view of the world. And it's really unfortunate because then we find a whole lot of guys are playing Xbox in their parents' basements at the age of 26 and 27 instead of growing up and starting families, and it becomes this very difficult catch-22.
It's very true, I have to say, and I don't have any particular agenda in terms of men's issues, but for years now on TV, the father is sometimes a nice, kind figure, but he's bumbling and he gets it wrong. And it's always the mother who says, unless he's a single father, which hardly ever happens, but the single father's there okay, but otherwise he's a bit of a clown, isn't he?
Yes, and even then, he sort of needs the women from the neighborhood to show him how to raise his children.
That's
and
right.
So on. Yes, and then when you do see the more masculine qualities portrayed, it's very often in a very negative way. I mean, he's too competitive, and certainly he doesn't share his feelings enough. And we all have seen the shows, right, where you have these talk shows and the women are talking about their horrific boyfriends who aren't sensitive enough and don't care about their feelings and, oh, those awful brutes. But if those brutes were coming on and talking about their wives and saying, you know what, she's just not having enough sex with me, well, we can't have that discussion, or she's too sensitive, or she's too emotional, well, that's off the table. Everybody has to look one way more and more culturally, and more, you have to look like a girl. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so unfortunate we're feminizing men instead of civilizing them, which has historically been the role that women have played. Now we just kind of want to make men into our best girlfriends, and I think it's very destructive for culture and family.
This is good. I'm not going to talk about she's not having enough sex with me because my wife might be watching and it really will be a problem, but the idea of looking like a woman. Now, it's one thing to be groomed to make sure that you don't smell bad. You know, I mean, I put on colognes and stuff like that, but there has been this tendency to almost blur the genders where men, I don't mean they walk around saying, look at me, we're holding their muscles up, but they have become effete.
Yeah, we definitely have gotten into this sort of, this melding, if you will, this homogenized look that I think is not necessarily particularly attractive. I tend to like manly looking men. But maybe that's just a signal of some other things that are going on in the culture when we really are sort of not valuing the more traditionally masculine qualities. And there's some reasons for that that don't have to do with feminism. I mean, we do have a economy now that really is beneficial to multitasking. It's more service oriented. We don't physically need the brawn that perhaps we once did. Women are excelling in high schools and colleges, at least here in the United States. There's this phenomenon of the super girl and all kinds of questions about where are the guys on college campuses, because it's the women who are applying more, getting in more, and then doing better once they get there. Mm. And the women tend to now, in most major cities in the United States, on average, young women are making more than their male counterparts, and on it goes. So some of this has to do with economics. Some of it has to do with a very feminist agenda that says the traditional male qualities of being competitive, of being a little more stoic, not always being so verbal, etc., are bad qualities. Instead of what we once understood, which is that men and women typically are different, and that's a good thing. We complement each other. Less and less today, I think, we're accepting of that. That has implication for families and communities and children and a lot of women who are single because they can't find good guys to marry.
Mm-hmm. But it's also the notion of sacrifice. It sounds archaic now, but if a ship was sinking, women and children first, which one feminist in this country said she thought was akin to hate speech, which is quite
I mean, now if you were on the Titanic, there wouldn't be that chivalry. There would be everybody for himself, right? And one of the reasons that's important, Michael, is because we used to understand that men are typically physically stronger and more aggressive. They have all that testosterone.
Yeah.
They can either channel it for good when it comes to women, caring for children, providing for a family, or they can channel it for ill. And that's why the vast majority of men, of people in prisons are men, and they're single men, because they've not channeled their aggressiveness rightly in a way that's helpful for society and for the culture and for the community. They've channeled it destructively. Well, now we have a lot of guys who just aren't channeling it at all, and we have a huge proportion. The latest check was around 25% of people in their mid-20s are living in their parents' basements. Most of those are men. They're much more likely to be living at home than women. And so then women are excelling in the world, and they're turning around and wondering about where all the good guys are. I think there's a lot of ways women play into this. And one of them, no doubt, is that women have become so sexually available outside of marriage, there's not as much reason anymore for guys to get married and have families. So that's another way that feminism, while it's done some good things, has really led to a whole lot of women in their 40s looking around and saying, where have all the good guys gone?
Yeah, I mean, there's probably not a man over the age of 35 who hasn't come across attractive, lovely, bright women in their 40s who say, I can't find a guy. I mean, that's absolutely
true.
I mean, there are legal consequences, too. There is now an assumption within the legal system in Canada, I think the U.S. is the same, that when it comes to a custody dispute or a separation, the father, I mean, I think invariably the mother probably should have custody, but the father is barely to be considered. If there's violence in the home, even if they've hit each other, it's the man who has to be punished. I think that's part of the consequence of this, isn't it?
Yes, we do see, and it is reflected, I think, a lot in our court system, a presumption of guilt on the part of men when it comes to pretty much anything. I mean, when it comes to relationships, it seems more and more, it's always the fellow who wasn't listening. It's always the fellow who wasn't communicating, and on it goes. And in the court systems, I mean, you can hear horror stories on both sides that women have really taken advantage of this. Other times you see men, when their wives walk out the door, being left very much holding the shaft. I mean, I'd personally love to go back to a fault-based divorce system in our courts so that you really do have to show who was more at fault in leaving the marriage and let the money and the children kind of follow the better parent, if you will. I don't think we're ever going to go back to that.
Yep.
But nonetheless, what we do need to do, and the way to get around this or to start changing things, and I'm working on a book on this very topic, is to encourage women, I think it starts there, to value traditionally male qualities in men and to value themselves a little more in their feminine qualities and not suggest that we have to sort of merge into one being, but that we do, as different genders, have a lot to offer. Yeah. We have a lot to offer the home and the family, and we need to start to kind of be rebuilding respect for that.
All right. I'm going to be a man here and say, you've got to be quiet now, because we've got... It's a real pleasure. Love to have you back on the show. That was terrific.
Great.
And again, have a wonderful Christmas. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much. Merry Christmas.
This, my friends, is how easy it is to sound pro-male these days. I mean, here we have a woman, obviously of the social conservative persuasion, who speaks in such a way that one would think, or should I say to the untrained ear, one would think was pro-male. Yet this woman, make no mistake about it, is a bigot, as bad as the most vile feminist, and in some instances, her ilk is even worse than the worst feminist out there. Why? Because her misandry is much harder to detect. Her misandry is wrapped up in and optimized to appeal to the primordial parts of the male brain. Her misandry exists curled up in a chivalrous, hind-brained male blind spot where the male rationality and logicality cannot permeate. This is evidenced by the matter-of-fact tone in which her and her white knight interviewer calmly, as if the topic of discussion was a routine weather forecast, discuss how men have lost their chivalry by refusing to die so that women may live on sinking ships. This is the modus operandi of the other feminism, the other side of the coin. I'm not going to call it traditionalism and white knightery, it's simply another form of feminism, since what feminism is merely a vehicle for female advocacy that acts on behalf of women. Feminism is the female herd desire for protection and provision, combined with a jealousy of the ones which provide that protection and provision. Feminism is active misandry, and traditionalism is its passive counterpart. traditionalism is an indifference and entitlement toward male suffering, while feminism is a pursuer of it. In traditionalism, we see this detached female advocacy at all costs whenever these conversations of sinking ships and what men should or shouldn't do in the event that they find themselves on one come up. You know, I've described it as misandry above, but it should be noted that this misandry is a cold, detached one. I mean, we don't see a seething hatred here of men, but we see a hatred of entitlement. This woman considers men to be such a lower form of life that it never even occurs to her that men want to live just as much as women do, that they may not want to die for some archaic rules of gender conduct, that they have minds and souls and dreams of their own. All we see is this oblivious female dullard and her white knight protesting that men aren't acting like the utilities they used to be. Again, feminism is about female supremacy, but traditionalism is about female superiority. Superiority of the kind that a princess daughter of the nobility would view a commoner blacksmith who's highly experienced in his trade. Now this blacksmith produces. He's skilled. He's knowledgeable in his trade. He's valuable to society. He will, in the course of his lifetime, fashion countless artifacts of productivity and contributions in the form of a real, tangible product. He is orders of magnitude more useful to society and to nobility and to the marketplace where his goods are sold than the pampered princess who, by virtue of her nobility, considers herself inherently, even infinitely superior to the blacksmith. As far as she's concerned, the blacksmith exists solely because she might expect a level of craftsmanship in the metal that her harps are made of that only the blacksmith can provide. And so if the king's decrees ever make it so that the blacksmith simply cannot afford to make harps anymore, she will appeal to her father, the king, to change his decrees. She cares nothing about the well-being of the blacksmith or the sulfur he inhales in a process of metallurgy that gives her harps just the right harmonics that capture her fancy. She doesn't have an interest in the well-being of blacksmiths, but an interest in what blacksmiths do for her and her harps. Any intervention on her part on the side of the blacksmith might be received with great pleasure by the blacksmith. I mean, he may say to himself, look at the quality of my product, that the princess would take note of the lacking created by the king's decrees that made it too costly to create harps as I once did. He might swell with pride, and deep down he may even convince himself that the princess actually appreciates her loyal and lowly blacksmithing subject. He might tell his son, the next in line to pick up the trade, that one day this princess of the people will be his queen, and that he should never forget the attention once visited upon his father by the honorable princess who took note of his work and argued to the king himself on his behalf. Throughout all of this, of course, the princess will have always seen him as an insignificant peasant who exists to toil over scalding flames day in and day out so that she can play her little instrument, and that's all he'll ever be to her. And yet, convincing the blacksmith otherwise can often end up becoming an exercise in futility, because it's what he wants to believe. He hates thinking that in the eyes of the princess, he may as well be an insignificant, albeit useful, insect. And this is what traditionalism is. This is what social conservatism derives from. The female, her pedestalization, her feigned helplessness, and the man's desire to believe he's just that strapping singular example of manhood for the job. He's the only one that can step up to the plate and help these innocent Rapunzels who dangle their hair from the towers so that men can come up and slay the dragon. This is the process by which men ceremonialize their own enslavement. If you need men to die for you, tell those well-meaning fools that they can have meaningless trinkets pinned on their lapels for acts of military bravery. That'll make them feel better about it right away. You're still asking them to die, of course, but at the very least they can feel, accepted. I still haven't figured out the motivations myself, but the point is that this is how the type of conversation that you just witnessed in this video has been allowed to become commonplace. I mean, it's such an amazing feat of cognitive dissonance that we just ignore this, that it would do us all a lot of good to say out loud what was actually discussed. I mean, let's just say this out loud here. What was said here is that the proper codes of conduct for humanity, the proper deal brokered between the genders, is one where men should feel compelled, like mindless lemmings, to drown, to die, so that women may live, with no other justification other than women are women and men are men. And that is violence. That is akin to saying that Asian people should die whenever white people or black people or Hispanics are in danger of dying, simply because, just because. Now, people try to explain it away with evolutionary psychology. They say, look at nature. It's full of male disposability, leaving out the fact that, of course, we created civilization, an artificial construct very distinct and separated from the chaos of nature, where we have philosophized and built rights that would never really exist without the artificial enforcement of civilization. We see this constant citation of the animal realm to justify male expendability, a realm which has no justice and no entitlements and certainly no rights. You see, when women stand to gain from male blood and sacrifice, we point right back to the animal barbarism we came out of. We ignore, almost as if by magic, the last 5,000 years of striving for civility. And like savages, we say, well, look at nature. It's everywhere in nature. In an instant, we're savages again. I mean, it's the way of the world. Men have always been disposable and always will be that way, so drown, you disposable fuck. Drown and like it, it's just the way it is. Of course, rape happens in nature all the time. And when it happens to women in human civilization, we go back to justice and liberty for all real fast then. And we, of course, should. I'm not saying that we shouldn't. Yet considering that expecting men to summarily drown themselves simply for being men and for the benefit of women is a crime that could easily equate in the caliber of evil to the crime of rape, this naturalistic view of the world seems a bit one-sided, doesn't it? So here we are, the supposed pinnacle of civilization, and it turns out that we haven't yet figured out that any self-professing civilization that is selectively civilized never was civilized to begin with. Our directional civility towards women and our look the other way attitude and our savagery towards men indicates to me that we never left the jungle. We're still a bunch of primitives and savages, but with technology and with medicine and with flammable carbon compounds that light up our homes. All of this technical prowess, yet when you strip away this surface decoration, the rights we claim to be universal and inalienable are nothing but artificial social constructs that our society selectively enforces, and when it can't get away with outright deprivation of these artificial rights, it creates social customs rooted in male expendability to mitigate these things. Now in this, we find the derivation of all of these other social customs designed only for men. We're talking about cultural memes like honor and chivalry. I mean, what are these things? They're buzzwords with no real fixed meaning, since these terms function as behavioral modifiers that rein in male self-interest. For the men of the Titanic, chivalry and honor meant nothing less than voluntarily discarding your life like a disposable piece of trash because of the implied superiority. Not supremacy, but superiority of women. You see, there's a definite difference between the feminist woman and the traditional woman, and the difference lies in how they reveal their disdain for the male gender. Female feminists view themselves as inferior to men, and this is evidenced by their obsessive need for female supremacy and their fixation with their simultaneous hatred and envy of men. You never see any creativity or invention or groundbreaking innovative thought coming from the feminists because they are fixated on one thing, men. Specifically imitating them as a gauge of whether or not men are superior to them. Now, in the perception is reality world of female thought, they don't care if they have to use affirmative action and women's only college grants to do it. They worry only about being perceived as being equal to men, or at the very least creating an environment in which political correctness silences any discussion of any kind of male excellence they can't compete with. These are the actions of a child with full power to handicap an adult she's obsessed at imitating, but feebly grasping somewhere in her mind that she isn't an adult, and so she hates the adult she so desperately wishes to emulate because even with all the handicaps, the adult still excels. Feminists seek to dominate men, and the need to dominate always comes out of a position of fear and weakness. One does not seek to dominate an irrelevant non-factor, one dominates what they feel threatened by. The female feminist seeks to disprove the inferiority she suspects of herself by establishing supremacy over what she views as her superior, the male. The traditional woman, however, is most certainly not threatened by men. She's infantilized as the feminist is, but she doesn't fear men. The traditional woman betrays her belief in her own superiority by feigning inferiority. She sees herself as superior to men. She sees herself as existing to be served by men. She doesn't dwell on the superiority she believes herself to have. This feeling of superiority is as drilled into her as much as the conditioning that boys receive from the earliest ages, telling them that they must serve and protect for women at all times. She experiences her sense of superiority on an almost unconscious level. She is a superior geisha, let's call her that, who can't be troubled with the unpleasantries of male life. Her place is among the finer things, the safe things, the gentle things, and she expects men to fulfill their role by granting her access to this delicate and leisurely existence that is her birthright. And men better damn well bear the brunt of everything unpleasant for her, lest her field of vision be sullied by the less than ideal facets of reality. So essentially, it's a fancy way on her part of imagining superiority of the infantilized adult child that the traditional woman is. Now, what do I mean by the infantilized adult child? This is a term I've often used, but I haven't given a fixed definition to. So we'll consult the brilliance of Esther Villar's The Manipulated Man for the exact definition. The following excerpt in response to the definition of the modern woman in her book states, quote, "Life offers the human being two choices, animal existence, a lower order of life, and spiritual existence. In general, a woman will choose the former and opt for physical well-being and a place to breed and an opportunity to indulge unhindered in her breeding habits. At birth, men and women have the same intellectual potential." Now, I wish to interject here because although I disagree with this statement to a certain extent, you know, I do think that men may indeed have some higher innate intelligence than women. It's certainly a possibility at the very least. But I think the discrepancy to which this difference in intelligence exists is, in my opinion, greatly exacerbated by this infantilization process she's describing. So going back to her quote, she says, "At birth, men and women have the same intellectual potential. There is no primary difference in intelligence between the sexes. It is also a fact that potential left to stagnate will atrophy. Women do not use their mental capacity. They deliberately let it disintegrate. After a few years of sporadic training, they revert to a state of irreversible mental torpor." She continues on to say, "Why do women not make use of their intellectual potential? For the simple reason that they don't need to. It's not essential for their survival. Theoretically, it is possible for a beautiful woman to have less intelligence than a chimpanzee and still be considered an acceptable member of society." Then she says, and this is one of my favorite quotes in the entire book, "By the age of 12, at the latest, most women have decided to become prostitutes. Or to put it another way, they have planned a future for themselves which consists of choosing a man and letting him do all the work. In return for his support, they are prepared to let him make use of their vagina at certain given intervals. The minute a woman has made this decision, she ceases to develop her mind. She may, of course, go on to obtain various degrees and diplomas. These increase her market value in the eyes of men, for men believe that a woman who can recite things by heart must also know and understand them. But any real possibility of communication between the sexes ceases at this point. Their paths are divided forever." End quote. You know, for all the accusations I get of being a woman hater or a misogynist or whatever, when I see Esther Villar, a woman herself, so eloquently and unapologetically explain this infantilized female, it makes me swell with pride that such a specimen of female brilliance exists. What beautiful insight in this woman. This is probably the most accurate depiction of the infantilized Western female there is. And so going back to the superior geisha description, let's replay a part of the video we just watched for a second.
"Off the table. Everybody has to look one way more and more culturally, and more you have to look like a girl." Mm-hmm. And I think it's so unfortunate we're feminizing men instead of civilizing them, which has historically been the role that women have played. Now we just kind of want to make men into our best girlfriends, and I think it's very destructive for culture and family.
So this is the superior geisha speaking here. You see, here she is expressing the meme of women as the great civilizers of men. You know, their mere presence confers into the hearts of men a desire for civility. This begs the question, what did women do exactly that compelled men to want to be civil? I mean, what did they invent to make civilization more tenable? Did they create agriculture? Did they discover some new branch of mathematics or engineering? Did they invent refrigeration to store meats in? No, I mean, they simply were there, existing and reproducing. And so with this meme, our civilization represses yet another truth, another lie to be uncovered at the twilight of our civilization. You see, by deifying the female, it degrades and spits on the monumental efforts of men that went into the building of civilization, and it places the praise squarely towards the credit of their female deity, the traditional Madonna that made it all happen by virtue of her mere presence. A goddess, you see, works and sacrifices for nothing. Such things are reserved for mortal men. A goddess has sacrifices offered up to her. And if these sacrificial offerings please her, she will continue to grace you with her presence. She simply willed civilization into existence, and it happened.
And one of the reasons that's important, Michael, is because we used to understand that men are typically physically stronger and more aggressive. They have all that testosterone.
Yeah.
They can either channel it for good when it comes to women, caring for children, providing for a family, or they can channel it for ill. And that's why the vast majority of men of people in prisons are men.
And to the sinners, the ones who didn't pay their tithes of protection and provision for families and for women and children, we see the goddess has passed righteous judgment. You see, men that aren't providing and protecting for women revert back to the savage animals they were without them. And that explains why so many men are locked up in prison. I mean, it has nothing to do with a privatized prison industry that makes it an endeavor of business to lock up as many men as possible. Nothing to do with a drug war that arrests male nonviolent offenders in the majority. Nope, we just haven't been providing and protecting for women, which is of course the sole purpose of male existence, you see. And what of the women that have been divorcing in droves? What about their turning their backs on a family unit and abandoning their husbands? I mean, she makes no mention of them or the fact that they aren't being warehoused in prison. Because for all of her talk about families, if you listen close, she also wants the women to have the option to reject families at their own discretion. This is why I'm deeply suspicious of traditional women. They have their own anti-male agendas, yet they talk the right talk. They have the biological hardware, that sort of childish feminine appeal that the untrained male eye falls for every time. But they're 100% and diametrically opposed to male sovereignty. Notice that most of what this woman advocated for was completely legal. I mean, unlike the feminists, she's not looking to legislate away male freedom. Instead, she opts to make you think that male freedom is servitude to her. And that is infinitely more dangerous than a feminist who broadcast her hypocrisy for everyone to see. I mean, she even stated that no-fault divorce should be removed. Not because she's interested in freedom for men, but because no-fault divorce, although extremely costly to men and in breach of several constitutional rights, signals to the unfortunate male undergoing it that he has been screwed. I mean, the instant one's bit by a mosquito, what does he do? He attempts to swat it. He sees an inflamed bite mark for an entire week on his skin. He knows he's been bit. The traditional wife will not engage in such reckless and wasteful parasitism. She burrows deep in your skin, you don't even feel it, and she gets nice and fat, and by the time you realize you want to excise her, you won't be able to do it without a very costly financial amputation as per the Western divorce courts. Her hope, of course, is that you would rather live with this parasite the rest of your life than to go through the painful procedure of removing her. And if you think I'm exaggerating, then you need to get acquainted with what we call the cheaper to keep her marriage. There's a lot of them, trust me. When men wish to reject this monogamous Cinderella fairy tale that is a nuclear family, when men reject this outdated, Mad Men-esque bullshit, just like women have done, then we're anti-family, or nihilistic, or fatalistic, or what have you. You see, the biggest problem with feminism isn't female self-interest or greed. It's a lack of male self-interest. Everywhere we look, we see female nature on full display. Hypergamy is in full mast right in front of our eyes. I mean, the 1960s loaded up an Enola Gay and dropped the cultural Hiroshima bomb that was feminism on a nuclear family. And now all we see amongst the rubble are social conservative zombies running around like fools leading fools, pointing in denial to the rigor mortis of their precious nuclear family as proof it's still alive. And anybody that points out that it's dead is anti-family, of course. You see the slightest appeal to reality to these people when it comes to the terminal state of the nuclear family drives them into a frothing frenzy. And let me explain to you, if I may, just why social conservatives and their ilk are so observant of anything they can label as being an attack on the family. Let me talk about the gay rights movement for a second. You see, I'm deeply suspicious of the gay rights movement, not of gay MRAs. Yes, there's a difference. I mean, my fight isn't against you. I have zero desire to tell you what you should do in your sex life. No, what I'm talking about is the political and cultural juggernaut that makes up the gay movement. I'm suspicious for reasons I'm not going to get into here, but I wanted to bring that up because with that said, what really pisses me off, regardless of my suspicions, is when we get some social conservative idiot rambling on about how it was gays that destroyed the nuclear family. You know, I'm starting to see what gay men mean when they say that women hate gay men because they're one of the very few groups of men that women can't control. These men, these social conservatives, male and female, who blab on about gays having an agenda to destroy the family are adhering to what I'll call the displaced anger dynamic. Picture the boyfriend, upon discovering his girlfriend's infidelity with another man that he's acquainted with. What do we see happen? We see rage and anger and a desire for revenge and all of the normal things one might feel after discovering your significant other's infidelity. But what's remarkable is the direction to which this anger is focused. It's never focused on the woman, you know, the one who cheated, the one in the relationship. The other man, of course, was just doing what most other men, including the boyfriend, would do. That is, taking advantage of an easy, no-strings-attached lay. But the boyfriend, as much as he wants to, cannot bring himself to level his anger where it belongs. That is, onto the female. You see, because although he hates her for humiliating him in such a way, he's too pussy-whipped to dare place any blame on the person that destroyed their relationship, who is, of course, the slut that willingly spread her legs for another man. So instead, he levels all of his rage and anger at the man who did nothing other than to partake of some easy pussy. He wants to fight him, to kill him even. You know, if he had just kept his dick in his pants, the lie that the boyfriend was living could continue. How dare he? How dare another man take the pussy that my incorruptible little soulmate sweetheart threw at him? How dare he mess up the Cinderella delusion he was living under? I mean, who does he think he is? So, since placing the blame on his girlfriend who cheated would mean confronting the fact that the, let's say, I don't know, 2 or 3 year relationship he invested his time and energy into was done so with a woman that never really cared about him, instead of seeing his precious little cupcake in her real light, he takes all of that displaced anger and focuses it on the man who popped the bubble he encapsulated himself within. Remember that the relationship is the basis of the family unit. First there's a man and a woman, then children, and then what you have is the nuclear family, which forms communities and nations and civilizations, etc. So what social conservatives are doing when they talk about how the gays want to destroy the nuclear family, you know, what all of this attack on the nuclear family rhetoric amounts to is just the jealous boyfriend that can't bring himself to see that women destroyed the nuclear family. That's right, women destroyed it. And instead of pointing to gay people, or Marxism, or feminism, or MTV, or Generation XYZ, or rap music, or leftism, I'm going to point to the fact that 75% of the divorces that comprise the 50% of marriages that end up in it are initiated by women. Did the leftists put guns to these women's heads? Did a bunch of leftists forge the signatures of the millions of women that divorce every year? Did the state make them sign on a dotted line by gunpoint? The answer is a negative. One can make the argument that women were given financial incentive to leave their marriages via divorce, but that would just leave us with the stark reality that the nuclear family, via the bribing of its female component, can be coaxed into its own self-destruction. Doesn't sound any better to me. Now, since uploading my traditionalism is nothing but business and the bottom line video, which is in the description box, I've waited patiently for anyone, even one person, to explain away this simple fact that the moment women had the opportunity to drop the nuclear family and find provision elsewhere, they did it in droves. Not a single person, for all their talk about Marxism, for all this talk about men going their own way being anti-family, we still have yet to see even one person explain this little pesky detail away. Instead, they choose to live in this queen-has-no-clothes mentality, pretending that women had nothing to do with a full-on divorce epidemic that they initiated in the majority. And so they erect this fantasy around themselves. What a shame that our queen is walking around in view of all of our subjects in the middle of the town square in the markets where the denizens of our rival nations trade with us here, and she's stark naked. I mean, we're a laughingstock. This must be rectified. Let's blame our garment industry. Surely the queen wears no clothes because the garments we produce aren't up to her standards. If we just make better garments, surely our queen would don the proper attire. Surely this was all done on the part of the garment industry as an attack on our queen's character. Damn those garment makers. Damn them and their evil plot to corrupt our queen. All this time, it never occurs to them that the queen, even before she became the queen, was a nudist by her very nature. And after becoming the queen, knowing that she could walk the streets nude with impunity, decided that she should show the world the way she really is, what she always has been, instead of keeping up the illusion her subjects have built around her. And so it is with the nuclear family. Women have shown us so many times that they aren't interested in being part of the nuclear family and will remain in them only for as long as more lucrative options remain unavailable to them. And these social conservatives, seeing their family unit going down in flames like the Hindenburg, need some great evil to point to, some great boogeyman. You know, damn those leftists, damn Marxism, damn them all to hell for corrupting our innocent women. Damn them for giving women no choice but to divorce us in mass. If it wasn't for the Marxists, women would have never been manipulated into abandoning their families. Damn them. You see, the question of whether or not female nature is insurmountable never was the question at hand. You know, my detractors love to repeat this meme in a rather childish attempt at radicalization typecasting, but that was never the question. The question to be asked is not whether or not women's hypergamous nature can be checked for the purposes of building a sex as a reward-based civilizational model. The appropriate question is whether or not the correct approach going forward is the current one of de-incentivized female hypergamy. You see, our civilization and all of these amazing accomplishments and technological marvels we've achieved is due in large part to the harnessing of the male drive to reproduce. The vector for this harnessed energy is the nuclear family unit. The nuclear family unit, when stripped down and put under a microscope, is an arrangement of prostitution. Whether we want to face that uncomfortable reality as a society remains to be seen, but that's what it is in its elemental form. Now, we accessorize it and we aestheticize it in hopes of masking the nature of this arrangement. And we've done that by wrapping it up in love and feelings and all these kind of buzzwords, you know, these intangible words we use to explain the chemical cocktails that flood our brains during courtship. The dopamine and the oxytocin and the bonding hormones. I mean, these hormones are so potent in what they do that human beings, in our arrogance and because we need men to believe in the fairy tale to extract their excess productivity, we've named it love. And we worship this love. I mean, we've exalted this biologically trivial act of human reproduction to the status of deification it has now. I mean, why do you think we talk about soulmates? Souls, as in the property of God, you know, that which transcends the flesh and passes on to the hereafter if it exists. We mix love and the esoteric concept of the soul as if the two are interchangeable. You know, we're soulmates, and we do so only to mask the fact that women contribute nothing to it. I mean, it's a veritable act of mysticism to have one of these so-called love bonds with a woman. And so we begin selling this lie to our boys essentially from the moment they begin to form cogent thought. You know, from about the age of, I'd say 5 years old, we begin to bombard boys with this white knight archetype, this rescuer of damsels, these glass slipper chasers, because boys, of course, become men. And what man will work for a family? What man will support a traditional parasite wife after having had an education in the hypergamous proclivities of the fair sex? Now, women most certainly aren't wrong for these proclivities. They are what they are, and I'd rather see them completely with the good and the bad, or at least what I perceive to be the bad. But remember that this fantasy we've sold to our boys in the age of the nuclear family is one of exclusivity. You see, we care so little about our boys having an accurate view of reality in women, and we depend so much on the harnessing of their productivity and creativity in pursuits of the Cinderella lie, that we sell them the con of the exclusive female, when female nature, specifically its hypergamous quality, is everything but exclusive to individual men. No, you see, female hypergamy seeks the animal breeding setup. It seeks the silverback gorilla. It seeks the alpha male, who will eventually be deposed by the up-and-coming alpha male, who has destroyed all other male outliers on the fringes, after which the females will immediately shed all loyalty to the deposed alpha male. There's no loyalty and there's no respect for past endeavor in the inner workings of female hypergamy. We're talking about Breifoldt's law here. Are you the dominant male or not? Yes, then you have access to the females. That's that. You see, we as humans have studied the mating habits and courtship rituals of various, I'd go as far as to say semi-sentient primates and cetaceans. And although I'm sure that they also, on whatever level of cognizance they have, feel extremely powerful feelings of closeness and companionship with their mates, you know, in our studies of them, though, we understand that there's nothing special or amazing about the bond between a male chimpanzee and his female counterpart. There's nothing to be expanded upon. Whatever it is they feel is biologically driven to get them to reproduce, and so it is with the human being. Now, you know, we are the only species capable of objectively analyzing our own reproductive behavior, with the caveat of also being under the influence of whatever biological and chemical processes compel us to carry that behavior out. And yet, instead of objectively analyzing it in cold, hard, scientific terms, we've opted instead to tell our boys that it's some act of communion with some abstract love deity. You know, that every couple's so-called love is unique and special, and under this false pretense, we erect entire civilizations and we watch them grow and flourish off the backs of men that were since childhood made to think that they desperately needed to commune with this love deity through their very own incorruptible, perfect Aphrodite, a goddess of his very own, who, by the way, even though she's a goddess, won't be able to pay her own bills and sustain herself in any meaningful way. Thus, our civilizations grow and flourish off of this singular lie, off of the irrigation ditch of the male belief in the quest for his personal love goddess, and these civilizations, their harnessed male energies, are so damn good at the sustained sprint of male-facilitated growth and expansion that they expand exponentially. And all of this explosive growth and technological innovation is predicated on the fact that although men have a certain technical intelligence, although you can teach men calculus and engineering and physics and all of these things, it's very hard to teach him to swallow a red pill he's conditioned to be terrified of. This red pill is that of female hypergamy, and our civilization is built off of men that need to believe it doesn't exist. Where the problem lies now is that we've progressed so much that women simply don't need men anymore, anywhere near as much as they did in the past, and consequently the pretty little lie of female fidelity and love and that special deified bond between men and women is unraveling and crumbling and imploding in on itself before our very eyes. And what a surprise now that Western civilization, which was built on this lie, built on the suppression of female hypergamy, is crumbling along with it. And because men are so invested, you know, because we can't bring ourselves to admit that the civilization we built was built on lies, we still can't point to the queen and say what everybody knows, that she has no clothes, and furthermore, that she wants it that way. Again, a civilization built on lies will eventually crumble under those very same lies. A civilization built on the purposeful ignorance of hypergamy will eventually crumble when enough men rediscover it. Picture the neatly ordered, relatively stable array of hundreds of mouse traps. There are spring mechanisms held open by a ping pong ball each individually. Imagine all of the work that went into carpeting a floor with mouse trap after mouse trap, and imagine how time consuming it was to pry them open and keep them open, each with its own individual ping pong ball. And then imagine this array as the collected works and achievements of Western civilization. Let's say that one of these mouse traps represented the advancements of female birth control, technological advancement and mechanization, and with these advances comes one revelatory free-flying ping-pong ball out of the ether, representing female hypergamy reassertion. What happens when just one free ping-pong ball is introduced into the system, our metaphorical dollop of unignorable female nature? What happens? Well, the first mouse trap is sprung, the ping-pong ball goes flying and it hits two other mouse traps. That one hits four, the next hits even more, and exponential chaos always ensues. So again, a civilization built on a woman as reward system, which also chooses to remain willfully ignorant of female hypergamy, which cultivates in its men and boys a belief that women view men in a way that they're just not biologically programmed to do so, is flirting with and will eventually fall victim to civilizational collapse. It makes you think, you know, what sad little people that lash out at everything around them, desperately looking for a scapegoat to satiate their displaced anger. You see, I'm not even angry at women for rejecting the nuclear family in droves once the opportunity allowed it. As I've said plenty of times before, I'm glad that women did this. Not about the money and children they confiscated in divorce. That, of course, was pure evil. But I'm happy they did it because it destroyed the little fucking dream world we were living in. And because I believe that in a society where women aren't coddled like helpless children, where their actions are linked to consequences, they can and will shake off the infantilization of women that the modern nuclear family breeds. And they just may emerge out of it. And this is the great fear of the social conservative. They just may emerge as fully independent, autonomous beings with their hypergamy intact. The social conservative's main concern has never been for men, but for whether or not women still need men. They are purveyors of the woman as the male's life mission and reward motto. And so when men no longer wish to carry women, and when technology and mechanization creates a reality of constantly decreasing need for the provider male archetype, we see a cascading rejection of the traditional family unit. We see cascading divorce is what we see happen. Now again, it's never been a question of whether or not women can be given incentives to curb their hypergamous instincts. The question is whether or not they should be. Social conservatives are terrified of a non-infantilized, independent female willing to provide for herself whilst having her hypergamous instincts still intact. That's what this is about, a fear of the unbridled hypergamy that will arise out of any society where women are expected to do for themselves. You see, whatever will replace the dead conventional nuclear family is something that will involve men taking into account an honest view of female hypergamy instead of this delusional motto where men believe their little special soulmate really truly loves them, and where women are required to pretend their hypergamy doesn't exist and that their reproductive habits aren't dictated by male status and money and the like. What replaces the dead nuclear family will be a demystified and scrutinized, transactional and reality-based arrangement where men and women, but specifically men, are under no false illusions about what's happening. It will not be deified, it will not be viewed as some ethereal bond between men and women, it will be viewed through a crystal clear lens of resources for access to sex and reproduction. Reproduction then will be commoditized, and so will sex. Prostitution will be legalized, and so will surrogacy. As simple as that. When the reality of the male-female sexual coupling becomes the default, only then will we see men and women in the right reality-based frame of mind to form something more significant than the traditional and conventional family unit. Until then, it'll just be the lie it is today. Now let's talk about women in politics in the current, left-right debate within the men's rights movement. We've seen plenty of right-wing politicians in the last 50 years or so since feminism first hit, and feminists haven't backed down from a single one of them at all. You see, women practice identity politics. They're not worried about winning political battles with men who refuse to do the same. No, you see, to many men, the men's rights movement is about an extension of a current political typhoon struggle between the left and the right, and how every MRA should pick a side and get on board already. You know, they're not about men's rights and issues. You know, a men's rights issue is, for example, the right for infant boys to not be circumcised, or the right as a man to face one's accuser during a false accusation of rape. Men's rights is about rights, or the deprivation of them, which affect men in the majority. You know, because I got news for you. If you examine the various freedom-shredding legislations that have been passed not only in America, but worldwide since 9/11 alone, if you examine the various executive orders by the Bush administration, the Obama administrations, you're left with a massive, an absolutely massive body of legislation to rectify. It all boils down to this contingent of largely right-wing, fake conservative men that do not want to see men self-interested. Meaning that blacks and whites and women and gays and atheists and Christians and Muslims can and most certainly will fight for the civil rights issues specifically benefiting their race or gender or sexual orientation or religion or lack thereof. But men, though, you know, we have to be worried about every other political group's grievances as well. I mean, we have to play fair according to their own definition of fair, because fairness, of course, is dictated by what all other competitors are allowed to do. But no, we have to play by our own rule sets because, well, I guess we have honor, you know, that thing that leaves us on boats to drown while everyone else lives. Feminists are not afraid of men in their political parties. I mean, they laugh at men in their feeble attempts to battle them on the political theater. Women don't fear politicians. We're talking about 51% of the voting bloc who happen to live longer lives with which to vote in, which are also biologically equipped and predispositioned towards getting men to protect and provide for them. I mean, you MRAs admittedly have your work cut out for you, and I wish you the best of luck. Now, I've given in previous videos what I believe to be the most efficient political approach. That's class action lawsuits against all legitimate forms of discrimination against men, guerrilla warfare, isolated legal actions that target specific instances of misandric human rights violations that cannot be reasonably defended in the court of law. I mean, we're talking about a campaign of purposeful pursuance of pro-male legal precedents that do not violate the rights of women. Instead, the course of action being put forward is the impossibility of dismantling an entire feminist and even larger liberal political infrastructure, a process that will manifest itself, according to GOP infiltrators, by voting politicians like Mitt Romney into office. Well, you know, that should work just fine, shouldn't it? Again, And sincerely, if it helps MRAs in any way possible, I'll gladly lend a helping hand. But the fact is that as it currently stands, men are outgunned big time in the political challenge to feminism they're planning on mustering. And the fact is that we haven't changed one major legislation yet. Now, if I'm proven completely wrong on this, I'll be the first to eat my words, but I've said this many times before, that I do not see a major victory for men on the political front. At least until the threat of a class action discrimination suit can come from anywhere from men of varying political stripes that get really pissed off wherever they confront misandry. The fact is that many men hate feminism and yet want nothing to do with the GOP, or the left for that matter, and so insisting to men that to be an MRA one must be conservative only works as a repellent to those men that want no political affiliation but do want to fight misandry, and that's exactly why over here, on this channel, men will not be expected to join this weak-minded political tribalism bullshit. If you're interested in male sovereignty and male freedom and how it can be achieved, you're more than welcome here. I refuse to say that in order to be an MRA, you absolutely have to be on the right or the left. I personally will try to advise you of the fact that I believe that both of these political parties are irreparably corrupt and misandric. But, you know, everyone these days is in varying degrees of wanting to reject the system while simultaneously needing to continue to believe in it. And this is why we see such polarized politics today. Society's subconscious is telling them that their political system is completely fucked, so they seek to divorce themselves then by one half of the political spectrum by you know, labeling them as the great evil, the great Satan that must be overcome if we would just defeat the left, you know, or if we could just, you know, defeat the conservatives that kind of tribalistic bullshit that never gets anybody anywhere. With this said, again, if I see an opportunity for me to be able to contribute effectively to the political efforts of MRAs, I will do so without hesitation. But for the record, my bets are on the war of attrition that both conscious and unconscious men going their own way are already in the middle of fighting. And my mission is to get as many men as possible to eschew traditional provider roles and traditional societal expectations for men. Now, while it's true that going your own way is an individualistic term varying from man to man, but it's pretty much common knowledge that many who have chosen to go their own way have a shared anti-traditionalist bent, and this is what I wish to focus on, not politics, as far as I'm concerned. The question of whether or not women can be effectively opposed politically should be asked. Women, who are far removed from any pretense of political fairness, stemming from our society's embracing of female dysfunction, you know, one of the many tariffs that a society which chooses to infantilize its women must pay. But because of these dysfunctions, we end up having a population of female children holding the immense powers of reproduction and their equally potent votes. The Twilight Zone episode of The Child Who Could Kill You Just by Thinking It If He Read Your Mind and Figured Out You Were Thinking Bad Thoughts About Him comes to mind. Women have this immense power and the reasoning capacity of children because they're cultivated to. And so in asking whether or not they can be politically opposed, you have to take note of the fact that political society, throughout the political spectrum, has decreased expectations of women and regards them with the full benefits that childhood offers in terms of consequences and responsibilities, or more accurately, a lack thereof, and at the same time upholds their very adult rights and privileges, and that little cocktail forms an impregnable juggernaut where one's own political soldiers will refuse to fight for you if you're perceived to be bringing out the big guns against women. If you attack women politically with the same ferocity they've attacked men with, then expect a backlash from your own political allies. I mean, it's amazing to watch. Now, as a matter of fact, I've even seen MRAs categorize women as inanimate objects, you know, that men going their own way focus too much on women and that women should be looked at as some sort of force of nature to be managed, or even a figurative inanimate forest or mountain. I've seen some liken women to a wild tigress. I'm not making this up. A wild tigress that can only be expected to attack. And that's how they justify their whole let's blast women back to the 1950s mentality. All of this, of course, is designed to portray women as innocent, lacking in all agency and responsibility. Because, of course, mountains and tigers don't vote, they don't divorce, they don't make false domestic violence accusations, and they don't take your kids. This is the political outlook of some MRAs. What do you think you're going to encounter in the chivalrous blue pill world of left-right politics? Let it be recorded here for posterity, and so everyone knows when and where it was said, that if men do not begin to see themselves as a political class, if they do not identify as a political group that is willing to pursue the rights and interests of men unapologetically, their political attempts will be utterly futile and dispatched effortlessly by the forces of politicized feminism and chivalry. Point blank, full stop. I'm making that prediction right here and now. With that said, I wish to reference the quote on the gateway to hell in Dante's Divine Comedy. "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." Now, I'm not talking about comparisons between hell and Western civilization. My referencing of this quote has nothing to do with hell at all, and everything to do with letting go. I mean, just letting go. That's what men going their own way means to me. I mean, I just stopped caring at all. I don't care if I ever have another relationship again, and although I do take it as it comes, I don't care if I ever get laid again at all, and I don't care if Western civilization collapses. I just don't care. You know, and the best part about letting go completely to the lies we've been sold is that you're completely free. I mean, I've never felt more free in my life. I'm crystal clear right now. Abandon hope, all ye who enter here. It's the only thing that feminists and traditionalists can't fight. That is men who stopped hoping in their system. I mean, they thrive off of your hope. Your talk of politics, they can smell the hope on that. They can smell the rancid belief in their system. The system where women in the state will always hold more authority than men do. And again, if this sounds too cynical, I welcome and will even help MRAs to prove me wrong, even if I believe it to be an ultimately futile gesture. I'm more than capable of exerting the required effort behind MRAs to help them see that the political system is just too far gone. I want to point out that the only act on the part of men that has drawn any introspection from the current male-female gender dynamic is one of passive resistance. You'll notice that traditionalist women like the one in this video aren't the only ones talking about where have all the good men gone. You know, feminists have posted numerous man-up articles themselves. It's the only thing that actually seems to register on the radar of both traditional women and feminists that something's very wrong here. And this is an act of attrition. The marriage strike is a men going his own way discipline. We know that many of the men avoiding marriage and consequently avoiding the liability of an infantilized female along with her legal property, that is the children you'll give her. We know that many of these men have never even heard of men going their own way, but the school of thought that is rejecting marriage en masse stems from a natural breaking point in the male condition designed to make him endure substantially and for extended periods of time, followed by an all-encompassing cessation of caring, a Rubicon point, if you will, of no longer giving a fuck, which once passed cannot be regained, which is also organic and walks in lockstep with men going their own way philosophy. And that, I think, is where the advantage lies, because in order to become a men's rights activist, for example, one must know that a men's rights movement exists. You know, I think at the very least, men are highly unlikely to start fighting for men's rights all of their own accord, without knowledge of a men's rights movement. But if men look around them at a world where gender interaction is defined by the parameters of Breifeld's law and hypergamy, and divorce and rampant unrestrained female sexual license, which again I have no interest in controlling, but if men look around them and see all of this divorce and see other men getting burned or being in miserable relationships with parasitic female ingrates, then they'll shut off in exactly the same way someone like me, who's cognizant of men going their own way as a name attached to this male shutoff mechanism, you know, they'll shut off in the same way that I did. This is why it's so important, as far as I'm concerned, to explore what catalyzes this male shutoff holding pattern. This is why it's so important to take a biological and anthropological look at what exactly causes male apathy as it relates to women. Again, the only thing that has caused any real panic as a result of feminism is decreasing marriage rates due to a self-perpetuating marriage strike and decreasing birth rates. So for all of this talk about political solutions, the only time that the feminist media seems to give any attention to what's going on is when what is largely a men going their own way approach, one of attrition and starving the machine and refusing to be the upholders and more importantly, the maintainers of families and marriages, then we see them panic with their "Where Have All the Good Men" articles. So in my opinion, it will be the men that have simply voted with their feet that will continue to drive down the marriage rate, that will continue to drive down the birth rate far past their already unsustainable levels, and that is ignored at the consequence of civilizational atrophy and death. That's all I really gotta say for now. Thanks for listening.